Father, thank you for this time, and thank you for the worship, Lord, and just that we're able to come before you. I thank you for the, Father, just even walking down the hall before church and just hearing people talking to each other. Thank you for the life, the kids running around, and just thank you, Father, for that life. And I pray that spiritually that we would be alive, that we would not be a dead church, Lord. We wouldn't have a name but be dead, Lord. I pray also that we wouldn't be lukewarm, Lord, but that we would be on fire for you, but the fire that comes from your spirit, Lord, not through our ability. And we thank you, Lord, for the sense of humor that you have to love people like us and to reach out and use people like us. We thank you for that, Lord. And just pray by your spirit that you would speak to each person here tonight, the things that you would have them hear from your word. Lord, I pray that you would guide me and Lord, and just enable your gifts to come forth and to touch people through your word. Pray in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, 2 Samuel 19, but to catch you up, we talked about last week that Absalom, David's son, had taken over, that he had rebelled against his dad was on the run and had taken off. But after that, David's forces kind of regathered and they defeated Absalom and his armies. So the armies have battled, Absalom is dead, but we're going to have a problem now is Israel's going to be kind of in a state of flux, kind of an in-between time. Well, we've rebelled against our king, and the guy that we followed is now dead, so what do we do? But we're going to pick up now in chapter 19. Actually, I'd like to back up into 18, in 2 Samuel 18, verse 33. David has received word that his son Absalom is dead, and we see his reaction. Then the king was deeply moved, and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said thus, "Oh, my son Absalom, Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." And so David is going to this place, to his chamber, but it's over the gate. The gate is a general area where people are going in and out. And here is David making this commotion, weeping over his son. And Joab was told, remember, Joab is the general of David's army. He's the leader of the military. "Behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom." Now notice the reaction of the people, David's people, people who fought valiantly for David. It says, "So the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people. For the people heard it said that day, 'The king is grieved for his son.' And the people stole back into the city that day, as people who are ashamed steal away when they flee in battle." Isn't that horrible? Because of David's reaction, because of David's inappropriate mourning over this rebellious son who wanted to kill him, the people who fought valiantly for David, those who were brave, who risked their lives, came back as if they were traitors. They came back as if they were those who steal away in battle. What does this tell us? It's an important principle. Our wrong attitudes and emotions hurt other people. Always. No one sins into themselves. When we flip out or we're angry or we're frustrated at something that shouldn't be, it always affects those around us. You ever seen that in a household? You know, there's that saying, if mama's happy, everybody's happy. You know, if mama's happy, then the whole, but if mama ain't happy, then the whole family ain't happy. That's how it is. If one person, it's just like a disease. If one of us has a bad attitude, wrong emotions, then it just spreads. And it's like a black cloud comes over the whole family. I remember this especially with me. I do it quite a bit, but more so when I was an unsaved person. And Brandy wouldn't even come over to see me on days when I was a big Cowboy fan. And if the Cowboys were losing, you know, she wouldn't even be around me because I was so ridiculous. And so now it's NASCAR that I get so angry about now. But, you know, moving on. The thing is, when there's something that takes hold of us, it's not that we shouldn't be angry or emotional over sin, or angry and emotional over the lost, or these types of things. But something that is wrong-hearted, that messes everything up. Now, also what's happening here in David's life is a form of coveting. Coveting is wanting that which you can't have, wanting that which you don't have. And that's what David is really doing. David is coveting his dead son. He's coveting that rebellious son. And you know what? You don't mean to do that, but when you covet something, you really despise what you do have. It's a form of lust. If you lust after another woman, you're despising the wife you do have. If you're coveting that car, you're despising the car that God has blessed you with right now. And so that's what David is doing here. David wanted what he couldn't have, and he did not appreciate what he did have. It says in the scriptures, hey, godliness with contentment is great gain. And I have to have confession time. This God really convicted me of this, because this is something that pastors fall into all the time. Pastor Ben and I from Pastor Ben, Calvary Chapel, Lubbock, were talking about when we see the stacks of visitor cards of all the people that visit and then never come back. And then it gets depressing. So after a time, you just kind of have to throw some of those away so you don't feel so bad. But you can be guilty of that coveting. Oh, these people visited. Oh, it seemed like they were going to be the ones to really do this ministry, and they're gone. All the while, what happens? Those faithful people who've been serving wholeheartedly, they steal back in because they feel like, oh, I'm not appreciated. You despise the people who are actually serving you, the people who are actually doing the job, who are faithful. So you have to be careful. Again, remember with David, he was guilty of letting his emotions rule. And we need to be careful. Emotions are not bad. God has given them to us, but they have to be in check by the Spirit. All right, so all the people are frustrated. The people are coming back in meekness. And then verse 4, but the king covered his face, and the king cried out with a loud voice. He keeps on going, oh, my son Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son. He's not letting it go. He's going to keep yelling and crying out. He won't be consoled. Then Joab came into the house. Now, we're going to see a lot about Joab today. He's an ungodly character, I know, but sometimes he has some good things to say. Joab came into the house to the king and said, today you have disgraced all your servants who today have saved your life, the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives, the lives of your concubines. That's true. He has disgraced them. These are people who laid down their life because they said, David, you're our king. You're the one God has anointed. We'll fight and we'll die for you. And David didn't care about them. Man, there's a lot for that. For to really honor your parents. You know, as we get older, we think, ah, we know better than our parents, and our parents, ah, this or that. And as we get older, we still think that. But your parents, how much did they give to change your diapers, to feed you, to put stuff on the table? And we despise them. And so Joab is saying to David, man, what are you doing, man? You're chasing after this guy who didn't love you, who would have killed you if he had the chance. And you're disgracing these people. They've saved you. Verse 6, I love this. He says, in that you love your enemies and hate your friends. For you have declared today that you regard neither princes nor servants. For today I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all of us had died today, then it would have pleased you well. Wow. Joab, man, he just puts the knife in right to the heart. And though Joab, again, he has many, many, many shortcomings, the thing is, it's good for people when they tell it like it is. You know, it says in the Proverbs, faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. And so I'm glad Pastor Dan in Houston was the one for me. Man, he just told me like it is. After I would come and do a guest teaching, you know, everybody would tell me, oh, Steve, that was wonderful. That was great. Pastor Dan would be like, well, he had his list of all the things that I did wrong. And I learned more from that. I grew from that. That was awesome. But another thing here is Joab is ungodly. But you know what? God can use, and he often does use, ungodly people to rebuke you. He does that. People might say something bad to you. They might say something in a mean way, but there may be that truth in it. That may be how God gets to you. Maybe sometimes Christians are just too nice to say anything. You ever notice that? Christian magazines, when they review a Christian CD, they won't tell you it's horrible. Even though it may be horrible, they'll talk about how good it is and how lovely. Sometimes God has to use the ungodly people. With Abraham, twice Abraham lied about who his wife was, said, oh, she's my sister. He's trying to hide the fact. Twice God used ungodly kings to rebuke him. Isaac, his son, lied also about his wife. Again, another ungodly king rebuked him. So don't think that, oh, you're just in the world. You can't say anything to me. God might use that person. Be careful. Verse 7, now therefore arise, go out and speak comfort to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, no one will stay with you this night. And that will be worse for you than all the evil that has befallen you from your youth until now. It says, okay, Dave, here's the plan. If you don't go down now and tell the people how much you appreciate them, how much you're glad for what they've done, we're going to go. We're going to take off. And you're going to be without a son, and you're going to be without a kingdom, because we're going to leave. And that's what he's saying. And that's what's going to happen, too. You know, because obviously if the people feel like their king doesn't love them, that he doesn't want to be their king, then why would they want him to be their king? And so Joab gives him this advice. Verse 8, then the king arose and sat in the gate, and they told all the people. So he sat in the gate. This was a place where rulers ruled, when you sat in the gate. So this is basically saying, David is saying, hey, I'm back in charge. And they told all the people, saying, "There is a king sitting in the gate." So all the people came before the king, for everyone of Israel had fled to his tent. They'd all gone and run and hide, but now they come back out. So that's a neat thing. David comes around. Verse 9, now all the people were in a dispute throughout all the tribes of Israel. There you go. Imagine that. The tribe of Israel always in dispute, saying, "The king saved us from the hand of our enemies and delivered us from the hand of the Philistines, and now he has fled from the land because of Absalom. But Absalom, whom we anointed over us, has died in battle. Now, therefore, why do you say nothing about bringing back the king?" See, here they are. Here's their hard place. They said, "Okay, guys, here's the problem. We all got together. Absalom wooed us." Remember Absalom? He was just the best-looking guy. He's tall, had this thick, lustrous Fabio hair. You know, it said that he was just awesome. And he just was so ate up with himself. He was so prideful, but he was able to woo the people. Every time they'd come to see David, "Oh, if only I were king, I could judge your thing." And they would go to bow down to him, and he would shake their hands, and he'd give them a kiss. And so they all went after him. They were deceived by him. But now, you see, they've all kind of thrown their lot in with Absalom, and now Absalom's dead. He's killed. His reign was very short. And now they're saying, "Guys, what are we going to do? We all went after Absalom. He was our man. Absalom, Absalom, we had the jerseys, we had the banners. And now he's dead. So what do we do? Why don't we talk about bringing back the king?" This is another thing we have to worry about, is the masses are very easily swayed one way or the other. Jesus never put his confidence in men because he knew what was in the heart of man. He knew that though they were excited for him today, "Oh, Jesus fed us, man, it was awesome. Fish and loaves like crazy." He knew the very next day if he didn't feed them again, they'd be gone. So we have to be careful about taking opinion polls and about, "Oh, these people are following me, I must be something." As soon as, you know, Johnny come lately, the new guy comes to town, they may jump ship. So you have to stay true. And so these people are saying, "What are we going to do?" Verse 11, so King David went to Zadok and Abiathar, the priests. These were the main priests, saying, "Speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house, since the words of all Israel have come to the king, to his very house? You are my brethren, you are my bone and my flesh. Why then are you the last to bring back the king?" So remember, Zadok and Abiathar, they were the priests. They had stayed in Jerusalem even when Absalom had taken over. And so David is sending messages to them and tell the tribe of Judah, because David was of the tribe of Judah. That was his home tribe. That was his family. He's saying, "You need to be the first to bring the king back. Hey, I'm of your people. Go ahead and bring me back, and then the rest of the people will follow. Why aren't you doing this?" Verse 13, and say to Amasa, now, David is political guy too. You know, the tragedy of it seems like as Christians or believers, as they get into politics, it seems like they kind of have to become political over time. And what he's doing here, Amasa was one of his nephews, but you know what, Amasa was the leader of Absalom's army. And so what David is going to do now, he's saying, "Hey, I'll make the leader of Absalom's army now the leader of my army. That'll kind of get those rebels back on my side." So he's kind of working the politics. At the same time, he wants to get rid of Joab. You know why? Because Joab is obviously, he's a dangerous guy, but Joab's a guy who's not really afraid of David. He's willing to disobey. David said, "Don't kill Absalom." What was the first thing Joab do when he found Absalom? He killed him. And so David is trying to work the system. But, you know, as Pastor Chuck talks about, when you Christians try to get in the worldly system, we usually get banged around pretty good. And this is not going to work out so well for David. So he said to say to Amasa, "Hey, are you not my bone and my flesh? You're my relative. God do so to me, and more also, if you are not commander of the army before me continually in the place of Joab." Hey, Joab's old news. He's out of here. Amasa, you're the new guy. So he wanted to win back that army to David, that rebel army. He wanted to win them back by taking their leader. And David is also, again, trying to remove Joab from power. Verse 14, so he swayed the hearts of all the men of Judah, just as the heart of one man, so that they sent this word to the king, "Return, you and all your servants." Then the king returned and came to the Jordan. And Judah came to Gilgal to meet the king, to escort the king across the Jordan. So this is a big deal. This is an exciting time. All this stuff's going on. So Judah says, "Oh, okay. He's the man. Yeah, this is going to be great. We're going to go ahead and bring it back. All's forgiven. We feel good about the whole thing. So they start sending people out to the Jordan. David and his people are on the other side, and let's bring them all back. Come on home, Dave. Verse 16. And Shimei, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, who was from Bahurim, hurried and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. And there were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, and Ziba the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons and 20 servants with him, and they went over the Jordan before the king. Interesting. This guy, Shimei, he's coming now. He's the first guy to come back and meet with David. What's going on? Turn back with me, if you would, to 2 Samuel chapter 16 to refresh your memories on who this guy Shimei is. Or Shimei, I don't know how his name's pronounced, but you see it right there. 2 Samuel chapter 16, starting in verse 5, we saw when King David had come to Bahurim, this is when he's leaving, Absalom's taken over, David is on the run. There was a man from the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera, coming out from there. He came out cursing continually as he came. He threw stones at David and all the servants of King David, all the people, and all the mighty men were on his right hand and his left. And also Shimei said thus when he cursed, come out, you bloodthirsty man, you rogue. The Lord has brought upon you all the blood of the house of Saul, and that in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has delivered your kingdom into the hand of Absalom, your son. So now you are caught in your own evil because you are a bloodthirsty man. Now, there was some truth to this. God had said, because of David's sin with Bathsheba, because of the murder of Uriah as well, that there was going to be fighting continually in David's household. But this guy Shimei, he was just laying it on David. Oh, okay, you're not king anymore. Throwing rocks at him, cursing him. And we see there Abishai, one of David's generals, hey, said, let me take his head off. Let me cut his head off. And David said, no, you know, maybe the Lord sent him to curse me. But now, let's go back to our verses here in chapter 19. All of a sudden, things have changed. And Shimei is all of a sudden coming out to greet David. Interesting. Verse 18. And then a ferry boat went across to carry over the king's household and do what he thought good. Now Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king when he had crossed the Jordan. And he said to the king, do not let my lord impute iniquity to me, or remember what wrong your servant did on that day that my lord the king left Jerusalem, that the king should take it to heart. For I, your servant, know that I have sinned. Therefore, here I am, the first to come today of all the house of Joseph to go down to meet my lord the king. So this guy had gotten wind. Okay, David's going to be back in charge. He might be looking to make an example of those people who kind of were against them. So maybe I should go with about 1,000 of my closest friends and perhaps see if we can work something out. Let's make a deal, Dave. Now, what can we gather from this character, Shimei? I think it's not wise to blow your top. I think that's an important principle for us. We were talking about that earlier, Ron and I. Just a lot of times your first reaction is not the wisest reaction. Somebody might send you kind of a mean email, and you might be tempted just to email them back right then. Maybe you should let the day pass. Maybe you should let some time go by, pray about the situation before you get back to them. I think in my mind of leaving a job on bad terms. You know, you go into your boss on that day, you kind of toss the stuff off his desk and tell him what a wonderful person he is, and you say all those things, and you go into your new job. 6 months later, that new business goes out of business. You have no options, and you have to go crawling back to your old boss. I think it's always good to leave things on good terms. I think everywhere you go, you should have a good witness. My next door neighbor is this tennis pro guy, and he's an awesome guy. And every time I meet someone that knows him, they always like him. Everywhere he goes, he leaves a good witness. And that's how we should be. But if we're all the time blowing our top, that's not going to happen. Proverbs chapter 29, verse 11 says this. A fool vents all his feelings, literally his spirit. A fool just lets it all go. He cuts it all loose, whatever he's thinking, whatever he's saying. There's people we know like that sometimes, that they just let it all go. Not in this church, just outside of the walls of this place. It says, but a wise man holds them back. A wise man, sometimes you have that, or a wise woman, you have that thing that you just want to say, and there's that Holy Spirit that says, oh, pull back the reins. Let's not say that. Be careful, because you never know how this life is crazy. You never know the loops or the twists and turns it takes, and somebody that you might just tell off today in your righteous indignation may need to be a friend later on down the line. So just simmer down and be careful. Verse 21, but Abishai, same Abishai wanted to take his head off earlier, the son of Zariah answered and said, shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because he has cursed the Lord's anointed? Abishai hasn't forgotten. He still wants to kill this guy. And so look what David says in verse 22. These are good words. David said, What have I to do with you, you sons of Zariah, that you should be adversaries to me today? Shall any man be put to death today in Israel? In other words, today's a day of celebration. Today's a day when I'm coming back to my throne. Today's a day when I'm being restored to my kingdom. Therefore, why should we kill people today? Today's a day of celebration. And I love what he says at the end of verse 22. For do I not know that today I am king over Israel? Good words. Don't I know that I'm king over Israel? What do I get out of this? You see, I believe that David was secure in the knowledge that he was king. He was secure in that knowledge. He did not need to kill his detractors. You see, in nations where there's someone who takes power in an illegal, immoral way, the first thing they do is they limit freedom of speech. They limit those who would speak out against them. They have secret police that go and take them out and kill them or imprison them because they don't want any detractors. But you see, that shouldn't be that way for Christians. If you know that God has called you to a certain place, to a certain ministry, know that you are going to have detractors. Know that you are going to have those that go against you. But there's no need to kill the reputation of those who disagree. But again, that's our first reaction often as Christians. We're doing some work. We're reaching out. Someone has something bad to say about us. Oh, you have something bad to say about me? Well, what about you? What about your kids? Your kids are pretty unruly. I tell you what, and we have this way of seeking, oh, you're gonna take me out, I'm going to take you out. If you're confident in what God has called you to do, that you're doing the right thing, there's no reason to just punch back when someone punches you. Jesus said you are going to suffer persecution. That's how it's going to be. I think of in John chapter 7, Jesus' brothers didn't believe. His own family didn't believe him. And they told Jesus, hey, there's a feast up in Jerusalem. Why don't you take off? Go to Jerusalem, show all your mighty works, show all these amazing things you can do, hey, because if someone's a great guy like you, Jesus, they need to show it off. And Jesus says, hey, my time's not yet come. Why don't you guys go up? Anytime's good for you, but my time's not come because I'm an enemy with the world. They hate me. And so Jesus just basically didn't blow up on him. He didn't say, well, you know what, guys? I know you're my brothers, but I know everything you've ever thought. I know every sin, and I could write it down and tell mom. You know, he didn't do these kind of things with his brothers. He didn't do that. He just said, you know what? You guys do your thing. I have my thing. That's cool. And I'll take care of business. Jesus didn't see the need every time someone attacked him to attack back. So that's how it is with David here. He knows he's king. Don't I know that I'm the king? He says in verse 23, therefore, the king said to Shimei, you shall not die. And the king swore to him. All right, verse 24. Now Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. Now again, Mephibosheth was the son of Jonathan. Jonathan and David were best friends. They made a mutual non-aggression pact, we'd say in today's political terms. They said, you don't attack my family, I won't attack your family. Hey, if you're in charge, I'll take care of your family. If I'm in charge, you know, I'll take care of your family. We'll get along together fine. And so Mephibosheth was the only remaining son of Jonathan. But he was lame in his feet because on the day Jonathan had died, his nurse had taken, she had run with him, she dropped him, his legs were broken, they were never mended properly, so he was a lame man. But David had taken him in as a son. David had treated him as a son, had him eat at his table. But what had happened is when David was leaving Jerusalem, when he was fleeing Absalom, Mephibosheth's servant Ziba came and said, oh, man, Mephibosheth turned against you. Mephibosheth is not on your side. He thinks he's going to be king now. And what did David do? He responded flippantly. He responded quickly. And he told Ziba, hey, all Mephibosheth's stuff is yours. All the land is yours. All the houses are yours. It's all yours. But it was a lie. Look, here's Mephibosheth. It says, and he had not cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he returned in peace. In other words, for the whole time that David was in exile, Mephibosheth hadn't taken a bath. He hadn't cared for himself in any way. He was mourning over David being having fled. And so Mephibosheth was a true servant of David. He was a guy that really loved David. So it was, when he had come to Jerusalem to meet the king said to him, "Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth?" In other words, when I went into exile, how come you weren't there? And he answered, "Oh, my lord, O king, my servant deceived me." That was Ziba. "For your servant said, I will saddle a donkey for myself, and that I may ride on it and go to the king, because your servant is lame." So in other words, Ziba took the donkey and took off, and because of Mephibosheth's condition, he wasn't able to go after him. And by the time he would have gotten there, hey, Ziba had already told a lie. "He has slandered your servant to my lord the king, but my lord the king is like the angel of God. Therefore, do what is good in your eyes. For all my father's house were but dead men before my lord the king. Yet you set your servant among those who eat at your own table. Therefore, what right have I still to cry out any more to the king?" He said, my whole family were dead dogs. In other words, when a king would take over in that period of time, they would kill all the family from the previous king. They would take him out. There would be no rebellion against him. But he said, you didn't do that. You've treated me well, so do whatever you want. Verse 29, so the king said to him, "Why do you speak any more of your matters? I have said, you and Ziba divide the land." So David's gone back and forth. When he first met Mephibosheth, he said, okay, all the land's yours, Mephibosheth. Ziba, you take care of it. Ziba comes out and lies. Okay, Mephibosheth's out. It's all Ziba's. Now Mephibosheth comes to him. Okay, it's half Ziba's, it's half Mephibosheth. You see what happens when we don't pray about things? You think what happens when we just do things flippantly without thinking? Then we always having to check what we said. We're always having to go back on it. And it's hard. It's hard when you go in this direction and then all of a sudden you have to say, oh, no, that's not what I meant. Let me start this again. People begin to lose confidence. People start to say, hey, do you know what you're doing? You know, I've heard of pastors doing this. They'll read some new book on the ministry. 6 months, they'll do it this way. All of a sudden, they'll read another new book. Oh, no, let's change everything. Let's go this way. And back and forth it goes, and nobody knows what's going on. But I love the response of Mephibosheth. He's in verse 30. Then Mephibosheth said to the king, "Rather, let him take it all, inasmuch as my lord the king has come back in peace to his own house." Isn't that awesome? He says, it's all right. It doesn't matter what he did. All that I care about, king, is that you're back. It doesn't matter if Ziba has it all, whatever. That stuff doesn't matter to me anyway. I'm just glad you're back. He's a good character. Obviously an overlooked character in the scriptures, but an honorable one. All right, continuing on. Verse 31. And Barzillai the Gileadite came down from Rogelim and went across the Jordan to the king to escort him across the Jordan. Now, Barzillai, I'm going to say it different every time I see it, was a very aged man, 80 years old, and he had provided the king with supplies while he stayed at Menahem, for he was a very rich man. And the king said to Barzillai, "Come across with me, and I will provide for you while you are with me in Jerusalem." We need to like update a Bible with just modern names. You know, we'll call that guy Barney and all kinds of different stuff just to make it easy for us. But he says here that, hey, this is a guy that helped him. Remember, David was on the run. When he had left fleeing Absalom, he was kind of disorganized. And this guy, Barzillai, was a rich guy. And he came out with beds for him. He came out with pottery, with food, with drink, everything that they needed. And so David, as he's going back, says, man, come with me. You're a true ally. You're a true friend. Everything that we have in Israel is yours. I'll give you whatever you need. I'll give you the best place to live and everything. And he's just offering this guy the world, all that he has, because of his kindness. Verse 34, but Barzillai said to the king, "How long have I to live that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? I am today 80 years old. Can I discern between the good and the bad? Can your servant taste what I eat or what I drink? Can I hear any longer the voice of singing men and singing women? Why then should your servant be a further burden to my lord the king?" I love that. You know how sometimes older people exaggerate? You know, everything is like, I'm almost dead. I got one foot in the grave. You know, I can't hear, I can't taste, I can't see, all this kind of stuff. And he's saying this whole thing. And he said, why should I be a further burden? It's funny, he hasn't been a burden at all. He's been a blessing to David the whole way. But he says, you know what? I don't need to come with you. says, your servant will go a little way across the Jordan with the king. And why should the king repay me with such a reward? Please let your servant turn back again, that I may die in my own city near the grave of my father and my mother. So he's saying, hey, I was glad to help you, Dave. You know what? But I'm just going to go ahead and live out my days in my own town. He's another good character. He's gracious. A person who helped, a person who was a blessing, but wanted nothing in return. What did Jesus say in the New Testament? He says, you guys, you know what your problem is? You're always inviting someone to your parties because you know they're rich enough to invite you back. You're just giving them an invite because you want an invite. He's saying, Jesus said, why don't you invite the lame? Why don't you invite the poor? Why don't you invite those people who have nothing to offer you? And that's really a danger even within the church. There's a danger to go and to look at a new place to plant a church and look at the zip code. What kind of houses do they have in this zip code? Wow, these are some pretty nice houses. I think this is a place to plant a church and to plant it where these people can offer you, you know, some kind of a great living. But the scriptures, hey, Jesus says, go after the people that can't give you anything in return. Go after those people that are truly needed. Oftentimes, we'll find as churches, we don't reach out to those people that are so down and out because they can't tithe. Because they don't have any money left over. But that's not how the Lord wants it to be. So this guy's an example of one who gives without ever seeking anything in return. He just wants to be a blessing to be a blessing. So he says, hey, I don't want anything. Continuing in verse 37. But here is your servant, Chimham. Most commentators believe that he was the guy who invented the ham sandwich. No, that's not him. Chimham, they believe that he's the son of Barzelli. So he says, hey, let Chimham go with you. Let him cross over with my lord the king and do for him what seems good to you. So take this kid with you. Take him with you. He's likely his son. Verse 38, and the king answered, Chimham shall cross over with me, and I will do for him what seems good to you. Now whatever you request of me, I will do for you. Then all the people went over the Jordan, and the king had crossed over. The king kissed Barzelli and blessed him and returned to his own place. Now it's interesting. I love how things pop up in different places. You don't have to turn there, but in Jeremiah chapter 41, verse 17 says this. Jeremiah 41:17 says, and they departed and dwelt in the habitation of Chimham, which is near Bethlehem, as they went on their way to Egypt. So it's pretty cool. So apparently this guy Chimham hung out with David and he settled somewhere nearby there in Bethlehem, and we see his name come up later. But it's just interesting to me to see how the things are intertwined. Verse 40. Now the king went on to Gilgal, and Chimham went with him, and all the people of Judah escorted the king and also half the people of Israel. So here's where it's going to get a little messy again. All of Judah. Judah is the southern tribe. The southern two tribes are Judah. They're the ones that David is relation to. They're the ones that first of all anointed David king. But it took Israel, the 10 northern tribes, 7 years later before they recognized David as king. You see, when Saul died, Judah immediately said, okay, David's our guy. But the northern tribes said, nah, we don't know about this David guy. I think the son of Saul, Ishbosheth, he's our man. Yeah, he's the one we're going for. So there's this division. There's this trouble brewing. There's this thing going on where, you know, Judah and Israel not really trusting each other. And so all of Judah comes out, but half of the tribes of Israel only come out. This division is going to bust wide open. One thing that this also tells us, and when there's problem with people, when there's issues within a church or within a family, it doesn't just go away. Oh, let me just gloss over these cracks. Let me just paint over them. It's going to be okay. It's not. The more time that goes by, just all kinds of nastiness gets in that crack, and the division grows bigger and bigger and bigger. Things have to be dealt with. Verse 41, just then all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king, his household, and all David's men across the Jordan? So all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, because the king is a close relative of ours. Why then are you angry over this matter? Have we ever eaten at the king's expense, or has he given us any gift? Here's a problem. Israel shows up, the tribes, and say, hey, what's going on? How come Judah gets to be the ones to bring him over? We want to bring him over. We want to do this thing. And it's so petty. It's so sad, because so many of these things that you see, these sins in adults, they're really the sins of children. You know, how come I can't play with that toy? How come they've got this? Only adults know how to use swords and guns and missiles and to settle their, or quote unquote, settle their problems. And so that's what's happening here. There's this division. Hey, we wanted to be the ones. We wanted to be in the parade. We wanted to be the ones to bring David back. And so it's a real mess. But Judas says, hey, he's our relative. What have we done? We've never taken anything from the king. We're just trying to do the right thing. Verse 43, and the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, we have 10 shares of the king. In other words, we're 10 tribes, so we've got 10 of him, and you've only got 2. You know, this kind of nonsense. Therefore, we also have more right to David than you. Why then do you despise us? Were we not the first to advise bringing back our king? Hey, we were thinking about it before you guys were. Yet the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. In other words, a big old argument took place, and the guys, basically Judah won. Now, what does this fighting reveal? Well, it reveals that a human king or a human ruler, no matter how good he might be, no matter how he might even be a man after God's own heart, he can't make it all better. He can't do it. You see, God wanted to be king over Israel. He said, I want to be your king. I want to be the one. But the people said, we want to be like the other nations. We want to be like everybody else. And so what this shows me is to look forward to Jesus' reign, for Jesus' return, to pray for his return, because only his reign will be perfect, you know? See, there's a great danger that we have. We can kind of get into hero worship, whether it be Billy Graham or whoever it is. Great men, godly men of you know, great men of God, but we just, oh, he's the one. Oh, that's it. But there's a great danger in expecting too much from men. There's a tendency toward hero worship. And what happens is whenever men becomes exalted in our eyes, God becomes diminished. These guys were looking at David. They weren't looking at the Lord through this whole thing. Oh, David's going to fix it up. David's going to heal our problems. No, the Lord is who they need to look to. And so it doesn't matter if it's a president or a senator or whatever. You can't put too much trust in them. It has to be Jesus Christ. If Jesus Christ is not the center, if he's not the ruler, if he's not the king, it's not going to turn out. It's not going to work out. All right, chapter 20, we're going to see that right away. Verse 1, and there happened to be there a rebel whose name was Sheba, the son of Bishri, a Benjamite. So this guy, this rebel, it literally means son of Belial. What does that mean? Or man of Belial. It means literally son of Belial, or basically son of Satan, is how you would say it. That's the kind of guy that he said he is. This is also used of, remember Eli's sons? Back in 1 Samuel chapter 2, Eli's sons, they were priests, but they were wicked. They would take the best sacrifices. They would intimidate people. They would have illicit sex with women who were coming to offer sacrifices. Wicked men. And this is the kind of guy that Sheba was. And unfortunately, it seems that wicked men often find a following. There's always people willing to follow them. It says he was a Benjamite, and very important, Saul was a Benjamite. Ever since Saul was removed and David became king, there's always been animosity. There's always been, man, it's not our guy anymore. He's not from our tribe. He's not our relative. I can't wait till someone from our tribe is king again. It says, and he blew a trumpet and said, we have no share in David. That was a quick change. Also, we have 10 shares till we have no share in David. Nor do we have an inheritance in the son of Jesse, every man to his tents. O Israel, let's take off. Another rebellion started all of a sudden. So every man of Israel deserted David and followed Sheba, the son of Bishri. But for the men of Judah, from the Jordan as far as Jerusalem, remained loyal to the king. So these half of Israel that had showed up, they take off again. Oh, we can't be the first. We can't be the one to bring him over. Okay, well, then we're going to follow this guy, Sheba. You think they would learn? You think that they, after following Absalom, that they would think a little bit better, but they don't. Now, David came to his house at Jerusalem, and he took the 10 women, his concubines, whom he had left to keep the house, and put them up in seclusion and supported them, but did not go into them. So they were shut up to the day of their death, living in widowhood. These were the 10 that were left behind that Absalom had raped. And so they were shut up in widowhood there. They were set aside. The king said to Amasa, assemble the men of Judah for me within 3 days and be present here yourself. So Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time which David had appointed him. So Amasa, all of a sudden, he's a new guy in charge. And David gives him 3 days to assemble all the troops of Judah. It's a big task, especially for a new guy. He's not able to do it. After 3 days, he hasn't gathered them all up, and therefore there's problems here because they're letting this rebel get some time. Verse 6, and David said to Abishai, "Now Sheba, the son of Bishri, will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him, lest he find for himself fortified cities and escape us." So he says, hey, I don't know what happened to Amasa. Abishai, you take these guys right here and you get going. Because if Sheba gets to a place where he's in a fortified city, a walled city, he might get a whole gathering and there's going to be a lot more bloodshed. We got to nip it in the bud. And that's really how it is with the rebellions. Whether in a church or whether in your kids or whatever, you can't let those seeds grow. You have to deal with the issue right away. See that within Absalom's life. David never dealt with Absalom's rebellion, and it became huge, and people died in the process. So it needs to be taken care of. So Joab's men, here in verse 7, with the Cherethites, the Pelethites, and all the mighty men went out after him. And they went out of Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, the son of Bishri. So they take off after him. And when they were at a large stone, which is in Gibeon, Amasa came before them. Notice, Joab wasn't invited to the party, but he shows up anyway. Joab's always on a mission. He was dressed in battle armor, and it was on his belt, a sword fastened in its sheath at his hips. And as he was going forward, it fell out. Joab's always a man with a plan. So he's going here. He's dressed in his armor, even though he's not supposed to be a general anymore. He's got his scabbard at his side where his sword is. And all of a sudden, as he's going forward, he kind of tilts it and kind of trips forward. So his sword falls on the ground. Then Joab said to Amasa, remember, Amasa's the guy who's taken his place. Amasa was the guy on the opposite team. He's like the quarterback of the opposite team. And all of a sudden, you're on the bench, and he's quarterback in your place. And Joab's having a problem with this. He says, "Are you in health, my brother?" And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. So he goes forward as he'd been leaning down, and he grabs Amasa by the beard like to give him a kiss on either cheek. But Amasa did not notice that the sword that was in Joab's hand. Joab had dropped his sword on the ground. As he leaned up, he picked up the sword with his left hand. You know, that wouldn't be the normal way that if someone were to attack you, it would be usually with the right hand. So he grabs him by the beard. He has a sword in his left hand, and he struck him in the stomach. And his entrails poured out on the ground, and he did not strike him again. Thus he died. Then Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Bishri. Man, Joab, this is not a guy you want to cross. This is not a guy that you want to make mad. Now, what can we gather from Joab? Well, he's cruel, he's ruthless, but also he's a man of great determination. I will say that for him. Pastor Dan back in Houston, he used to always say this, "Hey, if only we were as bold for good now as we used to be for evil." Remember when you were in the world and how you didn't care what anyone thought, you didn't care what they said, you just were going to do your thing. And it doesn't matter who you ran over. Well, now as Christians, oftentimes, obviously, you don't want to run over people, but we don't have that same determination. All of a sudden, we're very timid. But I look at the two that stick out for me are Jesus Christ and the Apostle Paul. They were determined. They were examples of that intense, godly determination. They were the flip side of Joab. It didn't matter. Ridicule, hardship, persecution, and even sure death did not stop them. They told Agabus told Paul, "Hey, if you go to Jerusalem, you're gonna die, man. They're gonna lock you up. They're gonna throw away the key. He says, "None of these things move me." Jesus, it said he set his face to go to Jerusalem to know that he had to suffer the cross. They didn't sway in their mission. So the thing, Joab, obviously he's a very ungodly man, but he was very determined. And Jesus tells us, hey, sometimes the guys in this world, the worldly people, they're wiser and more determined than you guys are. Maybe there's something you can learn there. Verse 11, meanwhile, one of Joab's men stood near Amasa and said, "Whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, follow Joab." Again, Joab was a man of great charisma. He had an incredible following. They see that he kills this other commander right before their eyes, and they're ready to follow him anywhere. But Amasa wallowed in his own blood in the middle of the highway. And when the man saw that all the people stood still, he moved Amasa from the highway to the field, threw a garment over him, and when he saw that everyone who came upon him halted. So everybody came walking up, and they kind of were freaking out. Here's the commander dead in the road, so they just kind of throw him aside. And when he was removed from the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bishri. And he went through all the tribes of Israel to Abel and Beth Makah and all the Barites. And they were gathered together and also went after Sheba. And they came and besieged him in Abel of Beth Makah. And they cast up a siege mound against the city, and it stood by the rampart. And all the people who were with Joab battered the wall to throw it down. So they get everything ready. They're besieging this walled city. And all of a sudden they get out the battering ram, and they're going to smash down the gates to get at this guy Sheba. And then a wise woman. It's interesting, the word wise here, it speaks of really someone who does something extraordinary. Someone who kind of goes above and beyond the normal. So she's a woman who stands out. She cried from the city, "Hear, hear, please say to Joab, come nearby that I may speak with you." They knew who was in charge. And when he had come near to her, the woman said, "Are you Joab?" And he answered, "I am." And then she said to him, "Hear the words of your maidservant." And he answered, "I am listening." So she spoke, saying, "They used to talk in former times, saying they shall surely seek guidance in Abel, or Abel. And so they would end disputes. I am among the peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city and a mother in Israel." Now, she wasn't talking about herself where it says a mother in Israel. That was in reference to cities that were very useful or cities that were important. They were called the mother in Israel because they would birth the people. "Why would you swallow up the inheritance of the Lord? Why do you want to knock down the city? What have we done to you?" Now look at Joab's answer. Joab answered and said, "Far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy." Yeah, right, Joab. Who are you kidding? This guy destroys everybody in his wake. "That is not so, but a man from the mountains of Ephraim, Sheba the son of Bishri by name, has raised his hand against the king, against David. Deliver him only, and I will depart from the city." You don't want me to break down your walls? Just give me who I'm looking for. So the woman said to Joab, "Watch, and his head will be thrown over you to the wall." Over the wall, I'm sorry. Then the woman, in her wisdom, went to all the people. So she got the city elders together. She said, "Hey, we got this thing. This guy Sheba is going to bring down our whole city. Let's get rid of him." And they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bishri, and throw it out to Joab. And then he blew a trumpet, and they withdrew from the city, every man to his tent. So Joab returned to the king at Jerusalem. Wow. It doesn't pay to be a rebel if you want to get ahead in life. You know, so because they cut off his head and they threw it over the wall. This is not good. And yet the interesting thing is people don't realize that this is how it always is. Always for a rebel, it ends badly. And even in the scriptures, it says, for rebellion is as a sin of witchcraft. And I think sometimes the Lord has to really work in our lives because we constantly want to rebel against the Lord. We constantly, "Oh, why are you doing it this way? Why are you doing this way?" If we would just sit down and say, "You know what, Lord? If this is how you want it to be, okay." And then he can continue to work. Verse 23. And Joab was over all the army of Israel, and Benaniah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Cherethites and the Pelethites. So David can't get rid of Joab. He's still there. Joab's the general. Later on, under Solomon, this guy Benaniah is going to take over the whole army. Adoniram was in charge of revenue. Interesting, the revenue there, it actually speaks of hard labor. It speaks of those people who were under tribute to David, those who basically, in a sense, were kind of like slaves, and they were the ones who built many things. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahud, was a recorder. Sheva was scribe. Zadok and Abiathar were priests. And Ira, the Jerite, was chief minister under David. Now, what is the final thing we can gather from all this stuff as we wrap up the mess, in a sense, that are these two chapters? The thing I gather from this is man just messes stuff up. Man messes stuff up. We need to let the Lord lead things. We need the Lord to fill us with His Spirit, to give us His wisdom, to take advantage of the things that He says in His Word if things are going to turn out right. I'll leave you with one final verse. Proverbs chapter 3, verse 5 says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He shall direct your path." Let's pray. Lord, I pray that You would guide us and the things that You can just show us through Your Word, that we would learn from the mistakes and the errors of others and even from our own mistakes, Lord, and just seek to have You lead us. And I pray, Father, as we just sing a couple more worship songs to You, Lord, that you would just bless this time, help our minds and our hearts to be directed toward you. And Father, I pray that just on that daily basis, we might gather those things from your word you would speak to us and that we would obey you. Lord, I pray that we would acknowledge you in all ways and that you would direct our paths. Just pray in Jesus' name. Amen.